As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Five things I need to know. We're going to do a guest five things and talk about just two things here with Alan Krueger. It's Professor Krueger of Princeton. Let's just do two things here within the time we've got. How's the minimum wage experiment going in Seattle?
I think the evidence is quite mixed for Seattle. The way I read it, it looks like experience with the minimum wage elsewhere has not had an adverse effect on minimum wage employers. You know, if you look at the Seattle labor market, it's booming. And I think that makes it a little bit harder to tease out effects of the minimum wage. But certainly in the aggregate, there's no sign that Seattle's high minimum wage has had a negative effect.
Within this is the crushing reality that if you raise the minimum wage, the wages go up above it. Not way above it, but there's a sequential, almost bucket brigade effect. Is that still true?
There's a spillover effect of the minimum
wage.
There's no question about that. And that's one of the challenges for one of the studies, which cuts off, you know, if people got a raise and got promoted and that was a result of the minimum wage, it makes it look like it was job loss. So I think that's a problem with one of the studies that's gotten a lot of attention.
The other two things we need to know, Francine, I'm going to bring this in, but jump in here, Francine, please. I love it. $70,000 a year, going up to $80,000 next year. Princeton, hi, Dad, what are you doing? Oh, I'm taking the economics of rock music. Are you kidding me? Have you gotten any hate notes from parents about the economics of rock music?
This is I have to say, the best class I've ever taught.
Yeah, but what do the parents think?
The students are learning so much. They're so engaged. I mean, what better way of teaching supply and demand than talking about iPods and streaming? And it's a great way of teaching economics, I have to say.
Yeah, and actually, this is a serious point, Tom. It wasn't Jay-Z the first one to kind of cut the middleman and going straight to Apple Music, right?
I think it was, on Surveillance, yeah. It's Jay-Z.
Does this help explain inflation dynamics?
That's an excellent question. You know, one of the questions I got from the students is, what's going on with inflation? It's a freshman course, Tom, and it involves a lot of writing, which was the goal of the course. And I have been talking about disruption and technological change and productivity growth. And I think, you know, what's going on with being able to buy products on the internet had put some downward pressure on inflation.
I was in a meeting yesterday with General Wurspan, and she turned to me and said, well, so what do you think, Krueger in Davos? And I said, you have to go to Davos precisely because of this. The answer is technology as an overlay is evident, large, and it's a mystery, isn't it?
It is, and there's really no better place to study it than the music industry. Think of all the technology that was, including the medium we're using right now, radio, and the role radio played in music. But go back to the gramophone and...
Francine can't do that. You and I can do that.
I only listen to Beyonce.
Well, the students didn't know what I meant when I said 8-track, so...
In the economics world, in Francine's world across the Atlantic, there's short-term, medium-term, long-term. In American economics, with a historic simplicity, there's take out medium term. There's a short term and long term. In Chicago, it's just do more microeconomics. And in Princeton, it's like do more history. Okay, I get all that. What does transitory mean? Transitory isn't in any of the textbooks, I would suggest. Transitory is in Chicago. Transitory is in Princeton. When Chair Yellen says transitory inflation, what does that mean?
Well, the way I interpret it is that we're not on the path that we think we're on. It's a transitory detour, but we're going to get back to the path that we think we're on.
Is the x-axis normal? Is she thinking short term? Is she thinking long term? Or is it a new invention on the x-axis?
I think it's a short term. My interpretation to transitory, which is a term I probably used in some of my papers, is that we have shocks which we think are going to fade. And because we think they're short term shocks, we consider it as transitory.
And Francine, that would be the two back to back press conferences mentioning wireless cell phone bills.
Right. And I understand that it's transitory unless it isn't anymore. Professor, in the UK, we had a shock, and of course, it's pound. So you can argue that we have transitory inflation here. But in the US, how do we know that these phone bills won't stay at the same level? I mean, it could be more structural.
Well, it could stay at the same level, but what's important is the rate of change. So we kind of absorb the transitory shock from prices dropping. That's, I think, the argument that one could quite plausibly make. Also, the U.S. economy is pretty diverse. And as much as the Phillips curve gets criticized, it is the case as the economy gets tighter. Traditionally, we see wage growth and we see inflation. That's been more sluggish in this recovery. But I think the underlying dynamics are probably there. I think they've probably been blunted by changes in the labor market, by weakness of labor unions in the U.S., for example. But to my mind, it looks like we're seeing some signs of that dynamic still operating.
If we see the tax overhaul that's been promised come into something concrete, so I don't know whether we see the details, but what would that actually change? Does it change dynamics in GDP significantly, or would that also be transitory?
It's a good question. I think it could have lasting impacts. Of course, it depends upon the shape of the tax changes. What's been proposed, if the state and local tax deduction is eliminated, that's going to dramatically affect state and local investment in infrastructure, hiring of first responders, things like that. Other sectors which will get tax cut could potentially expand. So I think the tax proposal and the broad outlines could have substantial effects on the U.S. economy. Also, I think we need to take into account in the long run the impact on the deficit. If the proposal from the Trump administration adds $2.5 trillion to U.S. debt over the next decade, I think that's going to affect our borrowing costs. I think it's going to crowd out private sector investment.
When we get to Jobs Day today, obviously it's hurricane-adjusted, hurricane aberration, and the answer is smooth out the moving averages. Do you do that? Do you take 3 months and divide it by three? I believe that's a little too much math for me this morning. How do you adjust to a one-off of hurricane data change? How does a pro do that?
Well, first of all, I think the first thing to look for is going to be signs of the hurricane. Hurricane Katrina had a major impact on employment. The tropical storm Sandy did not have much of an impact on employment, surprisingly. So I think you look at certain industries that are more weather affected, and you look at regions of the country.
But on a Matthew basis, Professor Krueger, I think the trip of the media is to take 3 months and average them together. And I'm going to suggest a pro like you says, no, wait and get more data and then regress it out to see where we are. So a guy like you can't go out 1 or 2 months. You got to go out 6 months or 12 months of data and then see where the trend is. Am I right on that?
Well, thanks for giving my answer. That's absolutely right.
And I think, did okay?
No, you did. That was an A answer, Tom.
That's amazing. I went from a C- up to a quality C+.
But, what I would say is, rather than averaging it, I would look for an add factor and say, for this month, what is it that we think we need to add to take out the effect?
Almost a plug-in, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I guess if you're in the markets, right, which is the difference between markets and maybe the pros, is that you need to take a shorter-term bet because otherwise you're going to lose money, right, Professor? Whereas if you're an academic, you can take the longer view. Do you believe that the way the markets are working are kind of distorting our economic views?
Well, I think that's true to some extent, but the markets are also trying to figure out how the Fed's going to interpret the jobs report. And I think many investors recognize that the Fed's going to take a longer run view and try to see through the effects of the hurricanes.
I have done this before with you, and I don't like doing it, Professor Krueger. We're going to rip up the script and go to an exceptionally important monograph you put out years ago called What Makes a Terrorist. I read every word of it, every footnote. I was thunderstruck at the time of how you wrote about the people that do these terrible things. Can you take your historic work, Who Becomes a Terrorist? Where does terror emerge? What does terrorism accomplish? Can you take that monograph and bring it over to domestic terrorism, like what we saw in Las Vegas?
Well, thanks for bringing up the book. And you have good timing, because the 10th anniversary edition is going to come out by the end of the year. And I wrote a new, quite long introduction asking exactly the question you asked me. Yeah. How have the results hold up over the last 10 years? Does this apply to domestic terrorism? I would be hesitant to describe Las Vegas in the same language as we talk about other acts of terrorism, since we don't know the motives yet of this individual, this disturbed individual. Looking at other incidents of domestic terrorism, both in the U.S. and abroad, the domestic terrorists look like they're more drawn from the middle rather than the elites. They're not the most impoverished, the least educated. They look like people who were on a path towards middle class, towards college education in many cases, and they fell off that path and became radicalized. So it's more pushed to the middle when it comes to domestic terrorism.
Professor, how has social media changed terrorism in the last 10
Good
years?
Good question.
It has had a profound effect. It's made it much easier for terrorist organizations to outsource terrorism, to recruit, to basically franchise terrorism. I think that's changed the nature of terrorist attacks. They're less catastrophic in their scale, and they're a little bit more sporadic. So I think it has had a major impact.
All right. How will it change in the next 10 years? Is it actually impossible to study this as with hard data like economics, because it has more to do with emotions and allegiances?
Well, that's a good question. It also has to do with counterterrorism activities. I think fundamentally, terrorist organizations are trying to pursue some type of a goal, and they're using the means that they think are going to be most effective for them in pursuing that goal. I don't think that will change, but I think the means that they have at their disposal could change as technology changes going forward.
This has been wonderful. It's so nice to see you, not after you sat having coffee in Venice, which was the last time. You're finally back teaching.
I was at a conference.
Okay. Well, we're never going to forget. Coffee with Alan Krueger in Venice while we're in the sweaty confines of Manhattan. Alan Krueger, thank you on this Jobs Day, always, in particular, the important perspective on the American labor economy. He is with Princeton University. And look for the new edition, I guess I should say, of What Makes a Terrorist.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Now on Bloomberg Radio, Bloomberg Television Worldwide, William Gross joins us. He is with Janice Henderson as we look at markets on the move. I know that on television, John Farrow and the team have been doing the market movement today, but yields higher, dollar stronger. Bill Gross, just simply, is it morning in America?
Well, it's certainly morning, beginning to be morning here in Newport Beach. I think to the extent that your question implies wages are moving higher and that the average wage earner will make more and spend more, I think that's probably a positive. I note that the wages, Tom, were revised higher in terms of the last month, and so we have a 2.7% YOY and perhaps headed higher. So I think that's good for American workers.
Within this is a pretty good revisions. I mean, we revised up, I guess, pre-hurricane and that. How does Janice Henderson adapt and adjust to the hurricane distraction?
Well, you basically try and throw it out for a month in terms of the employment numbers. You know, we're negative, as you mentioned, in terms of the job growth. So you throw that out. You look at the wages and you wonder whether or not that, to some extent, was affected by distortions, but probably not as much. And so this is definitely a situation here at Janus with analysis of the Fed, looking at the Fed, a rate hike in December. You know, as long as financial markets remain firm, they certainly are. As long as wages begin to rise towards, 3%, they certainly are. I think the Fed is slam dunk in terms of raising rates in December.
You know, John, David Weston's given me great charts on Bloomberg Daybreak on television, folks, of weaker Japanese yen. You've really got a jump condition to a weaker Japanese yen. And the idea here of a regime change. Bill Gross, not, you know, what you're going to do on this Friday morning in Newport Beach, but is there going to be a regime change within your Janus Unconstrained Fund? Because you're starting to get a little more lift and you're starting to get a little more wage growth.
Yeah, I think, you know, unconstrained basically means that you're not constrained in terms of duration. You can do other things as well. You know, the beauty of the unconstrained fund is it can go negative in terms of duration. That is basically looking for higher rates and making money off of higher rates as opposed to vice versa. And that's what, you know, we've done over the past few weeks, certainly in Germany and now in the U.S. You know, we're approaching critical levels. I think, Tom, on the 10-year, for instance, now probably at 240. I haven't seen it in the last minute. Mm-hmm. But now at 240, that we're at a 240, 245 critical level, a long-term downtrend line since the early 1980s, where interest rates have fallen by 20 basis points on average per year, and we're there at 2.40%. It basically means to me that, you know, if the economy is strong, if wages are in an up move, then, you know, perhaps we can break that trend line and move above 240. But for the moment, to me, technically, that's where we stop, at least for this day.
And this is so critical, folks. The idea of Bill Gross previously telling us 2.60%. Stephen Major of HSBC on this morning looking for, yeah, rates could go up, but then a damper. Let's take the word transitory, Bill Gross, over from Yellen and inflation over to William Gross, and you got to run a bond portfolio. Will these higher yields be transitory, and is it lower for longer, whatever that wherever that band may be?
Well, I think we are lower for longer. There's no doubt about that. And that is what the Fed and other central banks describe as the neutral real Fed funds rate, supposedly now around zero with inflation, you know, somewhere around 1.5 or so. But I think it won't be transitory. I think if, in fact, we move above 240 instead of 260, remember, I said that interest rates are falling by 20 basis points a year, and that 260 was about a year ago. But if we move above 2.40, then I think there is a chance that this long-term bull market in bonds is broken, and that bond investors should be on the defensive as opposed to the offensive.
That's an exceptionally important statement you've heard there from Mr. Gross in the over decade that we've spoken to us. Let's dive into that deeper now with, I'm going to quote to four digits, 2.3841%. Bill, with that important statement of a regime change with a 240 print, how do we adapt and adjust? Let's start with the equity market correlated into bonds. Is the stock market linked into your 2.40% yield world?
Well, sure, they're all linked. And you know, typical questions and responses, you know, to those types of questions will say, well, we're okay on the stock market until we get to 3% on the 10-year or 4% on the 10-year. I think we're inexorably linked on a much shorter-term basis. You know, it's not to say that 5 basis points on the 10-year will mean 100 negative points on the Dow, but those things are connected. It's all connected. You know, a recent last night article from The Economist in terms of the overvaluation of all assets, you know, to my way of thinking is true. You know, the low interest rates everywhere, and they're negative in many parts of the world still, basically have distorted prices in terms of equity, in terms of commercial real estate, in terms of spreads on high yield bonds, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yes, this is critically important on the 10-year. to define other asset prices. And if we move significantly higher, 240, 250, 260, you know, investors have got to understand that the connection is a negative influence on their asset holdings.
Bill, then one final question here, and I want to come back and really address this important statement from Mr. Gross, folks, on the idea of a regime change of 2.40%. When we do that, will we do it with glide paths of stability, or will there be a lot more volatility in those old jump conditions that made you gray years ago? Which is it going to be, Bill?
I think stability, because not many people will believe me in terms of the long-term downtrend. They look at other things. They'll look at the Bollinger Band, and they'll look at the near-term stochastics. And so, and the Fed will come in and try and talk markets down. So, you know, I think it will be a gradual up move. But to my way of thinking, if 240, 245, don't let me hedge it here, but if 240, 245 is broken, to me that's a significant sign that the long-term bull market is over.
We're going to come back with Bill Gross. You just heard one of the most important statements I've heard from Mr. Gross in well over 10 years, the idea of a regime change and the great moderation. If we go above a 240 on the 10-year, and let, you know, there's some wiggle room there. I don't want to nail them right down to that, but 2.38% up 3 basis points on the 10-year right now, with the 2-year yield up again another 3 basis points as well. This is absolutely critical. The idea of a regime change off of a 20-year, great moderation. We will do that with Bill Gross from New York, from London this morning. This is Bloomberg. With us, William Gross of Janus Henderson. Bill, what you said in our last section is so important over this crisis, and even before the crisis. It would be irresponsible if I didn't have you recapitulate it. Let me be clear here, Bill. You go from a 260, and if we get a sustained 240 yield, you would suggest that breaks the great moderation?
Yeah, above 240, Tom. And let me explain that, because it sounds like a lot of hocus pocus. You know, the 10-year started out at its peak in the early 1980s with Volcker around 14%. And the fact is, we can analyze this and look at it, that it's come down by 20 basis points a year to this point. It got a little bit lower a few years ago, of course, but that was below trend line. But the trend line was moving down at 20 basis points a year. And why is that important? It's important because it allowed for refinancing of mortgages. It allowed for more attractive purchases of homes. It allowed for corporate interest expense to go lower and profits to go higher. It was what the economy needed to sustain a 4-5% nominal GDP rate, which is really what the Fed's targeting. So that was the magic number per year. The Fed didn't mandate 20 basis points per year, but that, based upon their Fed fund decreases and their quantitative easing purchases, you know, is what it produced. Now that we're down to 2.4% and 2.35%, you know, it seems to me that the question is, can the economy sustain itself without lower and lower interest rates? And that will be the question. If it breaks 240, 245, investors will be of the assumption that perhaps the economy can survive on its own without lower and lower interest rates.
I know Francine Lacroix in London wants to get, and really take this globally here, wants to get into your bill. But one more question for me, and then an ample time for Ms. Lacroix. This is profoundly important, what you're saying, for the Fed. And all I can think of, Bill, is what you studied at Duke in years and years and years. Be careful what you wish for. If Janet Yellen gets a higher yield structure and a little bit higher inflation, what's the outcome that could mess up the central bank cart?
Well, the outcome is that they go too far in terms of Fed funds. And this is where I joined with Neil Kashkari. He's probably not the next Fed chairman, but he has been cautioning for a long time that there's a limit in terms of what the Fed can do and the economy can survive. Because on the other side of this argument, interest rates can't go too high because it's highly levered. And a highly levered economy with higher and higher interest rates, you know, runs into problems in terms of destruction and interest rate cover and the like. And so, a central bank can't go too high. Right now, just to add one additional point, Tom, other central banks are not of the same persuasion. They don't have the same stance in terms of raising interest rates like the Fed will do, in my opinion, in December. So you have this cushioning effect by the ECB and by the BOJ, where they're putting in $1 trillion worth of money every year. And so that's why I say the increase will probably be gradual as opposed to dramatic going forward.
Good morning from London, Mr. Bill Gross. Will the next Fed chair actually be central banker to the world or only to the U.S.?
Well, I would hope to the world. The U.S. dollar is still the global currency, and as long as it is, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that interest rates in the U.S. is set by the Fed on the short-term side, you know, are an important consideration going forward. Depends on the chairperson, of course. I think Yellen has treated, you know, the Fed as the global central banker, although she won't acknowledge that. But perhaps we'll get a different persuasion if someone like Cohen or I suppose even Powell, although I'm not a Powell advocate going forward, but they seem to be the choices that the market is talking about.
Who would you put in charge?
Well, strangely enough, I joined Jeffrey Gundlach in this one. It's not going to happen, I don't think. I won't predict it. But Neel Kashkari has got great experience in terms of the Lehman crisis. We know that. He's had experience at Goldman. He's had experience at PIMCO. I knew him for 3 years. He's a brilliant man, and he's got ideas that are a little bit different than other central bankers. He looks at the market a little bit different from a structural standpoint as opposed to simply a statistical Taylor model type of rule. And so, yeah, he's young. He's only been there for a year or two.
Right.
But he'd be my choice, but he's not going to be the choice.
Francine, I'm confused. Bill, who's a brilliant man, Jeff Gundlach or Neel Kashkari?
Neel Kashkari.
Oh, excuse me. I wasn't quite sure there. Okay, we've got Jeff Gundlach
and
Jeff Gundlach and Bill Gross on the same page, which is always good. Many would suggest, Mr. Gross, sir, that you're talking your book, not that Mr. Gundlach has ever been challenged with the idea of talking his book. What kind of economy would Neel Kashkari give us, say, versus a rules-based John Taylor of Stanford University?
Well, that's interesting, too, because Taylor's a potential choice. And I was looking up on your Bloomberg system, there's a model there, Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, and you can put in your own inputs.
Yes, you can.
It depends on what Taylor thinks is the natural rate of unemployment, and it makes a huge difference. If the natural rate of unemployment is 5.25 versus 4.25, which it seems to be at the moment, then Fed funds, you know, should be 100 basis points different. In other words, at 4.25, in terms of a NARU, as we call it, then the Taylor rule with some modifications in your system, you know, basically suggests that we're there in terms of where Fed funds should be. So what would Taylor do? He'd probably follow the Taylor rule. And, you know, at the moment, absent modifications, he'd probably raise interest rates a little bit. Kashkari, I don't think would.
Mr. Gross, I'm looking at dollar-yen. So it seems to be retesting 113. A lot of technical analysts saying if it closes above 113, it looks like 114 is the next big level. Actually, if the Fed hikes in December, who's the central bank that's going to have the toughest time?
Well, it depends on if they're fixated on their currency, and I wouldn't deny that they are, although they don't speak to it. I don't think the BOJ is moving. The BOJ is the last central bank to move off of their stance. The stance at the moment is a cap on the 10-year of 10 basis points and basically flat for short-term interest rates. They'll stay there until inflation, you know, sees the whites of 2% or higher, and that may not happen. The ECB is changing, as we know, probably will reduce quantitative easing. So I'd say the biggest challenge, as your question points out, is in terms of the BOJ. The yen will gradually weaken if they seem firm on their stance, and they, to my way of thinking, they will be.
Bill, one more question, if we could. You've been very generous with your time this morning. If we get the sea change view of Bill Gross above a 2.40 with the idea of the great moderation being over. Can you link that to your historic claim that financial repression will continue? Can you now say we may see an end to retirees' financial repression?
No, I don't think so. What would it take on the 10-year? Would it take 3%, 4% in order to begin to compensate savers and not to repress them? You know, probably, Tom. It's a shaky definition in terms of repression. But, you know, financial repression existed for 30 or 40 years after World War II until the Volcker era. And I assume that it's going to continue for 10, 20, 30 years here as well. And that means that, interest rates aren't going to keep going down. That's what I'm talking about. But they may not go up significantly. We will continue to be repressed. Yeah. Savers will continue to get the short end of the stick.
Bill, you've been most generous with your time and over decade that you and I have worked together. Thank you so much for this perspective this morning. Bill Gross of Janus Henderson there, really with all, what I'm going to editorialize as a regime change and what if we get out over sustained higher rates. That was exceptionally interesting, Francine, just a completely different tone given where we are. And as you mentioned, Francine, equity futures trade down, as Mr. Gross suggested, that's that correlation.
Yeah, it certainly is. If you look at some of the dynamics, so currencies seem to be moving one way, and actually futures, not liking the jobs report. So I wonder whether there's a little bit of dichotomy there, Tom.
It is always a well-timed conversation. And today, a more nuanced conversation with our National Economic Director, Mr. Cohn, of course, formerly with Goldman Sachs. Gary Cohn has been, I think, very transparent about the politics. Right now, here's David Westin with
Mr.
Cohn.
The White House, where we're joined by Gary Cohn, Director of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Welcome back to the program, Gary. Very good for you to join us. So we've been reporting extensively on these numbers since they came out an hour ago. And we've got the problems with the hurricane. It affected the overall number of jobs. But you've got really strong numbers on unemployment, 16-year low, and also on wage growth, 2.9% annualized. Let's put these in the larger perspective for us. Has it ever been the case in history that we've had a massive tax cut with this employment situation, that particularly that will involve deficit spending, at least in the short term? Have we ever done that in this country?
So, David, thanks for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Look, we at the White House are very excited about the numbers. You're right. There is some noise in the number because of the hurricane. And as you said, you discount that noise out, and you're looking through the numbers, and you're looking at the wage growth, and you're looking at the unemployment number, which is the real bright news here. Look, I think what the numbers are showing you, and the question you're asking me is, you're asking about President Trump's economic agenda and what he's committed to and what we're committed to here in the White House. We believe that the tax cut is essential to continue the economic growth that we've started. Yes, we've started some real economic growth. We've been rolling back regulations, but we need to continue the economic growth. We need to continue the wage growth here in America.
So do you have reason to believe it will not continue? And perhaps more pointedly, in history, we've always had deficit spending and tax cuts in really fallow times, not in the robust times. Right now, we have a pretty robust time. Why doesn't the president say things are going great? We don't need to really intervene.
David, we've had a couple good quarters of GDP, but we're still not on a sustainable level of growth that we should be and want to be here in the United States. We've been averaging about 2% growth. The president is not happy with 2% growth. He ran on a pro-growth platform, and he wants to deliver a pro-growth economic agenda. We believe that tax reform is necessary. We need to allow American companies to compete on a level playing field. Our taxes do not allow American companies, American business to compete around the world on a level playing field. Our corporate tax structure and our business tax structure is just too high today.
Hey, Gary, no one we talk to believes you're going to see sustainable 2.9% growth.
Okay. That you're arguing for our tax cut.
With the tax cut, no one thinks we're going to get sustained that either way. What do you say to that?
Well, We completely disagree with that. We obviously think, if you listen to what Kevin Hassett came out yesterday, our CEA director, he came out and talked about the economic growth that we believe, we strongly believe we will have by cutting business taxes and attracting business back to America, attracting capital back to America, growing opportunities here for employees to be employed, creating wage, more wage growth in the United States, and keep the sustainable system that we're at right now. We believe we can have 3+% growth with taxes and the regulation that we're in, the reg reform that we're after now.
Hey, Gary, I want to get your take on a Trump tweet. It was about the stock market. He says the stock market hit an all-time high. This is President Trump tweeting yesterday. Unemployment lowest in 16 years. Business and manufacturing enthusiasm at the highest level in decades. Do you really want a White House that's associated with record highs when you know how precarious that can actually be? And we've had like 46 of them for the S&P so far this year.
Look, President's committed to economic growth. He's committed to a pro-growth, pro-job agenda. The stock market is representative of what his agenda is and the fact that we're having real impact.
You're tying your success to what the stock market does? Come on.
We're tying our success to jobs, job creation, better opportunities for American citizens. The stock market just happens to represent that. You and I both know how the stock market is priced. The stock market is priced on expectations of future earnings of businesses. And those future earnings are basically representative of what they think businesses are going to be able to accomplish in the future.
Gary, I just wonder, if it is about the market, how this bleeds ultimately into the decision-making elsewhere. The next Fed chair, for instance, as an administration, are you sensitive to the way markets would take the next Fed chair and who it might be?
Look, we as administration are sensitive to everything. We're sensitive to all the policies. The president thinks about economic growth and he thinks about middle class Americans every day and middle income Americans every day and hardworking Americans every day and how he can put them in a better position economically, how he can help improve their life. That's what the president thinks about every day.
Gary, I want to know what you think about it, though. More specifically, for the next Fed chair, are you sensitive to how the markets may interpret that individual and their policies?
Like I said, we think holistically about everything. We're not myopic on any topic. We in the White House and along with the president have to think about all of the topics together. That's our job, is to think holistically about everything.
Well, let's think holistically about this. Do you think the next Fed chair requires a PhD in economics to really garner the respect of those on the FOMC, Gary?
You know, I'm not going to talk about the specifics of a search that's going on right now. I don't think that's appropriate.
So, Gary, can I come back to your tax plan for a moment? You say you're going to get to 3% sustained growth. Could you just explain to us exactly what in that tax plan will generate that? As you know well, economists say growth like that comes from two sources, and that is more people working, demographics, and productivity. What will those taxes, if you get your plan the way you want it, how will it either generate more people working or increase productivity?
David, we couldn't agree with you more. So when you lower the business tax rate on the pass-through entities, on the corporate rates, we make ourselves more competitive. We make it that businesses want to locate in the United States. When they locate in the United States, they have to hire labor. They go out and compete for labor. They hire people. We see wages increase because we hire people. We're also going to see enormous amount of productivity in these numbers because as we build new factories and we build new manufacturing, a lot of it's going to be technologically driven. So the productivity numbers are really going to grow by leaps and bounds because we are a technologically driven economy here. And we think that we can increase productivity dramatically by creating a tax code that allows businesses to compete here in the United States with with other countries around the world.
Gary, I know you got to go.
Of the White House, the National Economic Director there talking about policy and prescription and also, of course, always the politics of Washington. Our policy and prescription is to give you a data check. Dollar stronger, yen 113.38, the euro well under 117, 116.90 on the euro, sterling 130.34. Gold I'm watching carefully, now down $8, make it $9 this morning. That's really something to watch here. I don't have the chart in front of me. I'll work that up and try to give it out to radio first out on social, 10-year yield now rounded up 2.40%. We have had a weaker 10-year, a higher 10-year yield, I should say, over the last 30 minutes off the analysis of this important jobs report. Francine Kwan in London, I'm Tom Keene in New York. On Jobs Day, this is Bloomberg. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.